And hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now close to 8 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled Grandpa and Jake. And then it's Not a Smiley Guy, Little Red Sleigh, which is really a Christmas story, but, you know, why not? And then, if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Plus One. So, it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled Grandpa and Jake.
Let's turn the TV off, said Jake's grandpa. But I love this show, said Jake. It's not over yet.
Well, here, let's get your jacket on. There's some place I'd like to show you. A place my grandpa took me when I was your age.
Where is it? Asked Jake.
Well, you have to guess. I think you'll like it.
Why? Are there dinosaurs there? Asked Jake.
Maybe, said Grandpa.
Are we going to pick peaches? I love peaches.
Well, I think we'll do that later, said Grandpa.
Are we going on a boat? Asked Jake. I love boats.
No, but when we get there, we can see all kinds of boats.
Did your grandpa take you fishing?
No, he never did.
Are we going to the beach? I love the beach.
No, said Grandpa. It's inside.
Grandpa, are you sure you know where you're going?
Yep, it's inside with boats.
Inside with boats and pirates? We must be going to the movies. I love the movies.
Well, no, said Grandpa.
So no popcorn? But I love popcorn, and I'm hungry.
I know, said Grandpa, but look, we can eat hot dogs right here, and they're on a bench.
Grandpa, did your grandpa ever take you to a ball game?
He did, but we're not doing that today. Okay, Jake, just up these steps. Now take my hand and close your eyes.
It's not safe to walk around with your eyes closed, Grandpa.
Just for a second, Jake. Now open your eyes, whispered Grandpa.
Wow, I love it here. I've always wanted to come here. Here? Where are we?
Shh, it's a library, Jake.
Wow, look at all the books. I love books. Oops, sorry, Grandpa. Look at all the books. I love books. There are books about baseball, books about boats, books about pirates, books about dinosaurs, books about peaches, and books about books. Wow, you must have loved your grandpa, whispered Jake.
I did, and he loved me too, whispered Grandpa. Okay, Jake, time to go. The library's closing.
But we just got here. I haven't finished my book yet. I never want to leave. I'm not going. I'm not going. I'm not going.
Well, if you don't go now, you won't get to check that book out, said Grandpa.
What does that mean?
Shh, you can borrow it. It means you can take it home, and you can borrow a few more books, just as long as you return them.
And there they are, standing in line with everyone else, checking out books. Wow, said Jake. I love this. Grandpa, are we going home now?
Yep.
Will you read to me when we get home?
Oh, I'd love to.
Not a Smiley Guy. When baby Ernest was born, his parents stared down at him. They smiled. He enjoyed it. Nice people, he thought. What a good family to be born into. The only thing that would make it better would be some elephants. Well, when he got older, he discovered more smiley people. cousins, aunts, uncles, grandparents, some even laughed. He was secretly still disappointed by a lack of elephants, but you can't have everything. A joyous family? Who wouldn't want that? Who wouldn't be grateful? Despite the elephant shortfall, Ernest loved his town. It was full of friendly people, grocers, mail carriers, neighbors, all smiling. They looked like they enjoyed it. Ernest tried it out when he was a year old, mostly because everyone kept saying, "Smile for us, Ernest." But aside from the interesting, sketchy face sensation, it was not for him. "Do it again, Ernest," coaxed his father. Ernest shook his head, and that was that. Well, he did everything else they wanted. He learned to walk. Boy, did that make them happy. He learned to talk, ecstatic. He ate with a minimum of mess, no throwing handfuls of beets. Well, not like some. He taught himself to do up his own snowsuit. He could see they really thought that was cool, but apparently it was not enough. They kept asking for smiles. It was a little exhausting, to tell you the truth. Then they stopped asking. They started taking him places instead. Petting zoos, playgrounds, the state fair, ice cream parlors, the seaside, roller derby. "This is great," thought Ernest. "The world is so full of neat stuff." He thought a lot of people were kind of loud and over-smiley, but he wasn't one to complain. He noticed that on these adventures, his parents watched him. At the street fair, when the clowns came out, his parents didn't even glance at them. They watched him instead. He was beginning to think it was creepy. "You still want that smile, don't you?" he wanted to say, but he was too polite. Finally, they took him to a famous photographer. "Smile, Ernest," said the photographer. Ernest thought his parents were cheating to make someone else say it. Well, when they came out with a solemn portrait of Ernest, his father said, "Ernest, what exactly do you want?" He didn't wish to be demanding. After all, his father had asked. "An elephant?" he ventured. Well, he didn't really expect to get one. They didn't have the furniture for it. But the next morning, there she was. Her name was Marcia, and it's an elephant. Ernest took Marcia to kindergarten with him. It was his turn for show and tell. Wow, was that some class. Even the teacher was impressed. After school, all the children fed Marcia marshmallow peanuts, while Ernest's parents whispered with the teacher. On the way home, Ernest's father said, "We heard you didn't smile during show and tell." "Why don't you ever want to smile?" wailed Ernest's mother. "We got you an elephant." Well, she was so loud it scared the bejesus out of Ernest. He almost fell over Marcia, who was walking quietly home with them, eating more marshmallow peanuts. Then everyone calmed down. "We are worried," said Ernest's parents. "Why aren't you happy?" Ernest was surprised. "I am happy," he said. "I'm almost always happy. I'm just not a smiley guy." "Okay, oh," said his mother, looking happy now too. "Is there something else you could do to show it?" asked his father. "To let us know?" "Like what?" asked Ernest. "Dance a little jig?" Ernest gave it a try, so did Marcia. They were quite the sight. "Maybe not every time," said Ernest, stopping to catch his breath, because to be honest, it felt a little silly. "But now and then, can I still keep Marcia?" "Well, that's up to Marcia," said his mother. "Certainly," said Marcia, and she smiled. To her, it came naturally. "Well, we love you anyway," said Ernest's parents when they tucked Ernest and Marcia in that night. "I love you anyway, too," said Ernest. "I think I will love you all anyway, too," said Marcia, eventually. "But it's only my first day. Do you think you could get me a bigger bed?" "Of course," said Ernest's parents, because his first impression had been right. They were nice people. Ernest did a little jig lying down because, as usual, he was happy. He had everything in life he wanted, including an elephant. Who wouldn't be happy? You don't have to change, but for the people you love, you do what you can. Little Red Sleigh. In a quiet corner of a cozy Christmas shop, there was a little red sleigh as bright as Christmas morning. She wasn't very big, and she wasn't very fast, and she was very young for a sleigh. But deep inside her strong, sweet heart, Little Red had a big dream. She longed to become Santa's big red sleigh. Everyone in the shop told Little Red that her dream would never come true. It was impossible. She was too small, too slow, and much too young. She couldn't fly, they said, so how could she possibly be Santa's sleigh? Little Red wondered if these things might be true. Was she too small, too slow, too young? But she believed, deep in her heart, she could fly. Through the sky, she would soar like a bird. She could learn anything. She could be anything. And this Christmas, she was going to prove it. She would travel to the top of the world, find Santa Claus, and show everyone what she was made of. So, as winter fell, Little Red went north. Her journey was very difficult. She dragged herself through mud and grime. She crossed rickety bridges and braved treacherous paths. Soon, she started to worry she wouldn't make it to the North Pole before Christmas. Then she found some train tracks. "Where are you headed?" asked a friendly train. "The North Pole," said Little Red. "Off to see the big man, huh? Well, climb aboard," puffed Train. Little Red hopped onto the train, and they chugged quickly down the line. "You have so many cars," Little Red said. "I wish I were as big and fast as you." "Well, I wasn't always so big or so fast," said Train. "When I started out, I had just two stock cars. I worked up and down these tracks for a long time before they gave me a third. Then I earned a fourth, a fifth, and so on." "Oh, I can't wait to be as big as you," said Little Red. Train laughed. "Be patient, little sleigh. Life builds up one car at a time." As they steamed north, the ground gradually changed from softly rolling hills to vast icy mountains. After many, many miles, Train slowed down and stopped at a station. "Well, this is as far as I go," he said, "but over that ledge you'll find Yellow Truck, who can help you go farther." "Oh, thank you," said Little Red. As she slid over the hill, she saw a bright yellow truck loaded with Christmas trees. "Hello," said the little red sleigh. "Can you show me the way to the North Pole?" "Happy to," Yellow Truck said. "I'm headed that way myself to deliver these Christmas trees to the big man. Hop on." In the truck, Little Red snuggled between trees, surrounded by the sweet scent of pine. Yellow Truck drove down a narrow road, rounding curves, dodging holes, and gliding smoothly over bumps. "Wow," said Little Red, "I wish I could drive like you do." "Well, now, Little Truck," Yellow Truck said, "I wasn't always So, used to be, no one thought I could make deliveries. Then one winter, I took a load of trees up north. It was just a few. But the next time, I got more trees, then more and more. Life seems to build up one tree at a time. That afternoon, snow began to fall. Ice covered the roads. Yellow truck's tires slipped and slid. His windshield wipers ran faster and faster as the snow fell harder and harder. "Well, we have to pull over," hollered Yellow Truck. Little Red could barely hear him through the whispering wind. She closed her eyes and held tight. She feared that if she flew off, she would be lost. Then she would never find the North Pole. When they stopped, Little Red carefully opened her eyes. Snow was still swirling, but through it she saw lights twinkling, red, green, blue, and white. Was this the North Pole? Had they finally made it? "Do you see Santa Claus?" asked Little Red. She strained her eyes, but could see nothing through the blur of falling snow. "I'm sorry," said Yellow Truck. "We didn't make it to the North Pole. We'll have to stay here until the storm lets up." Little Red nestled deep into the bed of Christmas trees, thankful for the shelter. But as she watched the snow pile up and up, her heart felt heavy. She'd come so far, and it was nearly Christmas. How would she ever get to the North Pole now? Little Red fell asleep, sniffling and wishing for Santa. In the morning, the sun rose high and bright. The storm was over. "Happy Christmas Eve," Little Red said. "Will we get moving soon to deliver the trees in time?" "Oh, afraid not," said Yellow Truck. "My tires are stuck tight. I can't go anywhere today. But you should take a look at the town. I'll keep an eye on you from here. You never know what you'll find when you look around someplace new." Little Red thanked Yellow Truck and slid off the trees, out the back and down the street. She hadn't gone very far when a pair of mittened hands suddenly picked her up. "Oh, wow, a sleigh!" A little girl in a purple parka hugged Little Red to her chest and held on tightly as she ran down the street and up to the top of a hill. The girl sat on Little Red, and then Little Red was just the right size for the little girl. Together, they flew down the hill again and again, sledding through the snow. Soon, other children joined in. Little Red played all day, helping each child soar through the air, watching their faces light up with joy. "This is what it feels like to fly. I'm doing it," said Little Red, her heart bursting with pride. At supper time, the girl in the purple parka brought Little Red back home. When Little Red closed her eyes that night at the end of Christmas Eve, she felt like she was still flying. The next day, on Christmas morning, Little Red woke up and sighed. She hadn't made it to the North Pole. She hadn't met Santa Claus, and now it was too late. Little Red was so disappointed, she started to cry. But then she noticed a small red envelope tucked beside her. It was addressed to her. "Dear Little Red, Christmas is a time for giving. Each year, I deliver treasures to children around the world, hoping to bring them joy. But sometimes, I need a little help. Yesterday, you delivered Christmas joy to many children. Thank you so much. You made each of those children very happy, and you did it just by being yourself. You are a very special sleigh indeed. I could really use someone like you up here in the North Pole. As a special thank you, you are cordially invited to visit me in the North Pole next year as we prepare for the holiday. Merry Christmas. Love, Santa Claus. Little Red couldn't believe her eyes. The North Pole? With Santa Claus? Her dream had come true. Just then, the little girl in the purple parka bounded down the stairs. Little Red was ready. At last, she understood what she was meant to do. She would build her life up, spreading joy, one child at a time. And the last picture is Santa Claus and his sleigh. And of course, inside the sleigh is Little Red. Plus one. Agnes was new in town and wanted to make friends, so she invited some girls in her class to a fancy tea party. You, plus one, are invited to a fancy tea party today at 4 o'clock, 417 Elm. As soon as Agnes got home from school, she started getting ready for the guest. That must be the girls I invited over, thought Agnes. And actually, a boy was the one that picked up the note. It wasn't. Hi, my name is Dave. I live next door, and I'm here for the tea party. Agnes didn't want this strange kid at her tea party. Well, the invitation says plus one. That means you need to bring a friend, said Agnes. And since you don't have a friend with you, goodbye. And she shuts the door. And then he knocks again. Yeah, for my plus one, I would like to introduce you to my esteemed friend, Pierre of the North. Esquire, said Dave. Onk, 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 and it's a Canadian goose, said Pierre. Your friend is too loud, said Agnes, and she closed the door. Boom. Knock, knock. This is my friend Fred, said Dave, and he's holding a cactus. He's more of a thinker than a talker. Said Agnes. Sorry, but I'm going to have to say no. Your friend seems a bit prickly. She slams the door and then knock, knock. This smooth fellow is my friend, Dr. Scallywiggles, said Dave, and he's holding a snake. I met the good doctor while looking for bugs under rocks. Is that a snake? Asked Agnes. No, actually, he is a legless lizard, said Dave. The difference is, boom. Agnes shut the door. Knock, knock. Oh, that better not be Dave again, thought Agnes. This is a snake. And now he's holding this huge snake. Agnes slammed the door. No cold-blooded guest. Knock, knock. This is my mom, said Dave. She gives great hugs, she makes amazing French toast, and will let me win at tag. Impressive, said Agnes, but no grown-ups. Slams the door. Knock, knock. Guess who? Said Dave. Allow me to present Captain Rufus and Admiral Angie. Protectors of the high seas and their two dogs. Oh, puppies, come right in. Oh, not you, though, said Agnes. Wait, said Dave from the other side of the door. You should know they're not housebroken. Agnes put the puppies outside and then shows Agnes cleaning up puddles on the floor. She looks out the window. She sees Dave and his mom and all the other animals. I was just wondering, said Agnes, if my friend and I could play tag with you and your friends. Then Agnes is outside and she wants to play with them. The usual group of friends huddled up. Honk, 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 said Pierre. Pierre wants to know what your friend's name is, said Dave. She's holding. This is the Honorable Justice Matilda Bearclaw III, said Agnes, and she's holding up her pet teddy bear. Well, Your Honor, said Dave, you're it.
And now they're chasing each other. She throws the bear up in the air. One of the girls, Agnes, had invited over, caught Justice Matilda Bearclaw III. "Sorry, we didn't get here sooner." "We had soccer practice," said the girl. "Is it too late for tea?" "It's never too late for tea," said Agnes. Then she invites all the girls in. They're walking into her house, and Dave is standing outside with the goose. "Honk," said Pierre. "Of course, you are invited, Pierre," said Agnes, "and bring our friends." And now everyone's invited. And I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled, When Alexander Graced the Table. Sundays were the highlight of Alexander's whole life. Before the sun could kiss the dew on the lilies, Mom's slippers would swish down the hallway. "All right, time to get up," she would sing. The smell of bacon and sausage and buttermilk biscuits would follow her through the doorway. And on the most special Sunday mornings, when he had some extra time, it would be Dad's crab gravy, hot and sweet. Dad liked having a little sweetness. But that was the beginning of the day, not the best part of the day. That came after church, when the whole family, Mom and Dad and Alexander's sisters and Papa and Grandma and Auntie and Uncle, would gather on the porch for a grand Sunday dinner. Sundays were joy. The week may have been long and a little tough, but Sunday dinners meant family was there for you. They gave faith in tomorrow. They'd spend all Saturday night preparing for their big feast. Alexander's mother was queen of the kitchen, stirring and chopping and humming a tune while she got a little taste here and there. "Don't forget the dessert," Dad would call out when the flavorful smells filled the house. Alexander stayed right by Mom's side. She would put him in charge of things, peeling the eggs for the potato salad, shredding the cheese for the macaroni and cheese, shelling the pecans for the pie. Alexander loved how doing these things with care made food amazing. He looked forward to the day when he could make something special for Sunday dinner, too. The only time Alexander wasn't near Mom was when he went out back to pick ingredients, fresh string beans and collards from the garden, and lemons for Dad's favorite lemon pie. Sometimes Papa would climb off the porch where he'd be relaxing with Grandma and meet Alexander out there. They would look over the land where just months earlier they'd dropped seeds into dirt and trusted in tomorrow. Water and patience. That's all anything living needs to grow, Papa would say. All that Saturday night, pulling and cooking always made Alexandra extra proud. They cooked with love, and that could be tasted in every bite. But Alexander's father always seemed too busy to notice. One Saturday night, after hours of cooking for Sunday, Alexander was hungry. He had a taste for Frank's and beans, his favorite. Mom was too tired to cook them. "You want Frank's and beans? You cook them yourself." Alexander's eyes lit up as his mother laid out everything he needed. Onions, hot dogs, a can of beans, salt, pepper, and a pot and spoon to cook it all up. Alexander got right to work, and he wasn't nervous at all. Cooking by himself for the first time was a thrill. He let his mother take the first bite. "Now that is good, baby," she said.
Alexander's father didn't want any. "Well, I'd rather a little something sweet," he said, looking around the kitchen. Alexander was disappointed. He wanted his father to taste his food and like it. "Tell you what," Mom said, pulling Alexander close, "why don't you make something special for your father for Sunday dinner?" Oh, Alexander's eyes grew wide. "All by myself? For the whole Sunday dinner?" he asked nervously. "Yes, dear," Mom said. "I know you can do it." Alexander knew just what to make. Graham crackers were involved. So was sugar, butter, eggs, and a can of thick, sweetened, condensed milk. And lemons. Lots and lots of lemons, fresh off the tree. Alexander beamed with pride when he put his dad's surprise in the oven. He used some of that patience Papa always talked about while he waited for it to brown. His mother placed the finished pie, still warm, in her special cake plate, the one with the top, so it could keep Alexander's secret. The next day after church was done and Sunday outfits were changed for less fancy clothes, and the cool breeze floated over the Sunday porch table set with care, and Dad and Papa took their places on the ends of the table, and everyone bowed their heads. It was time for that Sunday joy. What a meal! Alexander so enjoyed his dinner and the warmth of the gathering that he forgot about his pie and the butterflies in his stomach until, that is, his mother announced, "Everyone, Alexander is going to grace the table with a pie he made all by himself." Alexander's sisters looked on quizzically. Papa and Grandma smiled. So did Auntie and Uncle. Dad sat quiet. Alexander's belly turned with worry. Would his dad like his surprise? Alexander excused himself from the table and appeared again with a cake plate. "Lemon icebox pie," he said shyly. "Dad's favorite." "Mighty fine looking pie you got there, Alexander," Papa said as Mom cut it into slices and spooned them onto her fancy Sunday dessert plates. Dad inspected his dessert and gave his plate a good turn or two. And then he sliced his fork into the sweet, creamy lemon filling, all the way down to the buttery graham cracker crust. Alexander held his breath. A soft breeze made the leaves dance in the trees, and Alexander's whole world danced too. There was Papa in the garden, and Mom's gorgeous hum, and hot dogs and beans in the sizzling pan, and forks scraping plates clean. And Dad's words, as gracious as the dessert was delicious. "That's some good pie," he said. It was a Sunday memory Alexander kept in his heart of his father, the family table, and a love so sweet. And this is just a reminder, my name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue reading the novel that I've been reading now close to 8 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She spent her whole life waiting for that perfect, magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, last week, Darcy and Russell are still driving to L.A. in the 1970s Bronco. Darcy is now driving, and Russell is talking and playing music from musicals, which he's majoring in college in Michigan. He's talking about his dad making an endowment to Michigan State so Russell could get in. And that's where I left off last week. But then he said that he hadn't seen it from my point of view, and that I don't have to go if I don't want to. If what he did really changes how I feel about it, it's my choice if I want to go or not. He said he'd still donate the money. Oh, well, that's good. That school is famously underfunded. Russell smiled and looked out the window, turning his phone over and over in his hands. So, what are you thinking? Well, I'm not sure. I wish there was some way I could know if I could do it on my own. Well, you could do that, right? What do you mean? Well, you didn't get into the Michigan Theater Program, right? Just the regular school? Russell sighed, yeah. But you said you really wanted to do a BFA track somewhere. I did, he said, and I could hear some frustration coming out in his voice. But I didn't get in. No, I know, but since you're not even going to the part of Michigan that you wanted to go to, couldn't you just, I don't know, defer for a year, write a different musical, and then apply to where you really wanted to go? USC and what were the other schools? Oh, Temple and NYU, he said slowly. I guess I could. I thought about it when I only got in two places, I said, remembering the very long, sleepless night I'd spent on my laptop trying to figure out if I had any options and if I could do anything in a year to help myself. But the most I can really do at this point is get good grades and then transfer. I wouldn't be able to change my application all that much. It's not like I have a musical to write. Yet, I acknowledged with a laugh. We drove in silence for a beat, Russell's fingers tapping restlessly on the steering wheel. I don't know, he finally said, his voice hesitant. It's strange to even consider not starting next week, like stepping off the path. You know, all my friends are going to school. Most have already started. Mine too. But if I had a year to work on a new show, it was like I could practically see his wheels turning. Is it crazy? That never occurred to me until you said it. Am I just very stupid? I laughed. No. I think it's just the funnel we're all put through. Well, it's probably the same with you, but my whole life it's been do this to get that so you can get into college. It's like you're on a treadmill and you're not encouraged to ever get off or look around or go wander. Exactly. Dee Dee was thinking about maybe taking a gap year. And her parents lost their minds, like even the thought that she might not go right to college really, really freaked them out. So what did she do? Well, she's currently at Colgate stealing her roommate's Twizzles. Russell nodded. We slowed down. I could see there was road work ahead, everyone being pushed over to the left lane. What about you? He looked across the car at me. How are you feeling about starting tomorrow? Well, it feels like too soon. Like we're here now in the middle of the desert and tomorrow I'm going to be in Connecticut? I want more of a transition or something. Fun fact. Bring it on. I'll play that one next. When I just stared at him, he shook his head.
musical joke. Never mind. But one of the reasons it's called jet lag is that it didn't exist before planes. When you would, like, cross the ocean to get to Europe, you'd have enough time to be fully adjusted by the time you arrived. Well, unless you hit an iceberg. Well, exactly. But is it going to be hard tomorrow, seeing your mom? Well, I won't be seeing her tomorrow. She did offer to get me from the airport, but I said no. I waited for the surge of anger I always felt when Jillian came up, the one that I invariably pushed away a second later and pretended I wasn't bothered by. But for the first time in a long time, it didn't come. I could feel the vestige of it, an outline, like a crime scene chalk drawing representing something that once had been there but wasn't any longer. I looked over at the window. This normally would have been the moment I would have played with a button, pressing it up and down. But there really didn't seem to be much point to that with non-automatic windows. What was I supposed to do? Crank it up and back down again? Russell glanced over at me like he was waiting for me to say more. I just gave him a shrug and he gave me a nod, like he was somehow letting me know that when I was ready to talk more about it, he'd be there. We headed down the highway, the desert unspooling before us. There were rest stops and service stations, but they were getting fewer and farther between, and more of the signs now were telling us when the next service station was, so that we could prepare accordingly. And as we drove, an idea was flitting around in my head and not going away, to the point where I absorbed very little of Russell's favorite song from A Little Night Magic. And when he asked me what I thought, I shrugged. I struggled to find an answer. "It's okay," Russell said, shaking his head. "We don't have to keep listening to these. I might have hit you with too much Sondheim." It actually helps if you can read the lyrics while listening. "I don't want to stop," I said, and saw a flicker of relief pass over his face. "I was just thinking, has anyone ever made a musical of Theus's sailboat?" "No, I kind of think we might be the only two people who've ever read it." "Don't you think it would make a good one, though? You did say that musicals can take place over one night. There could be a great love ballad when they first met, and the campers could have their own songs, and the cat, too." "The cat?" "Snoopy sings." I honestly hadn't known there was a Peanuts musical until Russell had played me songs from You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. "That's true. I can't argue with that. So what do you think? I mean, I'm sure it would," he said slowly, like he was trying to figure out what I was talking about. "So you could write it. If you wanted to do a new musical, you could base it on the book." I glanced over at him to see what he thought about this, but he was already shaking his head. "I don't have the rights. I'm not saying that you need to get it produced, but just to have something to reapply with. If you wanted to do that, you could, right? Isn't there some kind of exception for students if you're not going to try to sell it?" I looked across the car at Russell and smiled when I saw that his eyes had lit up. "Okay, I had a thought," Russell said. He'd taken out his copy of Theus's Sailboat and was using it for reference, talking through plot points as we tossed around ideas. I'd secretly been hoping that when he pulled out the book, he'd put his glasses back on. But it seemed like maybe he had his contacts in now, and I might not get to see him in glasses again,
which honestly was incredibly disappointing. We were on a stretch of highway that was a straight shot toward the horizon, mountains in the distance that we kept driving toward, but somehow never seemed to get any closer to. Three lanes and a shoulder with short, scrubby, green bushes on the side of the road. The sky was huge and blue and endless above us. Wispy, white clouds drifting across it. The road wasn't very busy. I was staying in the middle lane, mostly to avoid the trucks barreling past in the right lane, and the cars on the left whipping past us at speeds that seemed, even on a fairly deserted highway, really ill-advised. But the openness of the road and the real lack of traffic made me feel like I could relax into the drive, leaning back against the cloth-covered seat and resting my elbow on the window, occasionally letting the wind drift through my open fingers. "Darcy?" "Oh, sorry," I said, glancing away from the road for a moment to look at Russell. He was bent over his book, the way he had been the very first time I'd seen him. "What did you say?" "Oh, just that I had an idea. What do you think about this?" "The camp song can be a motif we keep revisiting. It can be threaded through the whole show. And then in Act Two, when the campers sing, Will can actually be having a duet with his younger self." "We've gone through this," I laughed. "They're not the same person." "Okay, except they totally are. Give me some proof." "What about the scar they both have on their left hand?" I frowned. "Remind me." "Here, I'll read it." He leaned back against the door, one leg bent. He cleared his throat, then started to read out loud. And as he did, I had to catch my breath. "I was in a vintage car, windows down, driving across the desert. A very cute guy was reading to me from my favorite book. I'd wanted to go to Silverspun so I could have some memories to hang on to before I left, of mountains and sunshine and music. But that all seemed so short-sighted now. As I let the familiar words wash over me, I knew that Silverspun was only going to be a blip in my memory, more of a means to an end than anything else. This was what I would remember and take with me and think about in November. The wind in my hair, the sun on my legs, Russell in his sunglasses reading to me, the endless horizon in front of us. Emma traced her hand over the small crescent-shaped scar on William's thumb, letting her fingers rest there for just a moment before, bang! A sound like a gunshot ripped through the car. I jumped and Russell yelped, the book tumbling to the floor. "Fuck! Darcy, what was..." But before I could even think about answering, the Bronco swerved to the right, out of my control. Oh my God, I said, all in one word. I gripped the wheel hard and tried to swerve back, but overcompensated and veered into the left lane. There had hardly been any cars on the road, but there were some now. In my peripheral vision, I saw a blue sports car barely get out of our way in time. Everything seemed to be happening very fast and very slow all at once. My heart was racing. I could feel the adrenaline coursing through me. Everything on my body screaming, "Danger! Danger! Danger!" The car was shaking, the steering wheel getting hard to hold on to, the wheel pulling right even though I wasn't turning it that way. "Gonna pull over," I managed, and Russell turned to glance behind him. "You're clear." I put on my turn signal, then slowed down, feeling the jerky movement of the car that I knew couldn't be good, and then pulled off the road, the steering wheel fighting me the whole time. When we were on the shoulder, I shifted into park, shut off the engine, then lifted my trembling hands from the steering wheel.
The whole thing had probably only taken 30 seconds, but it felt like I'd just run a marathon. "What happened?" Russell asked, sounding as shaken as I felt. "What was that?" "I think it was the tire," I said slowly. "That sound, the gunshot sound, I knew it. I'd heard it once before." And just like that, a memory was nudging at the corners of my mind, one I hadn't let myself replay in a long time. I had been 7. Jillian had been in Ashland, Oregon for the summer, understudying in the Shakespeare Festival. My dad had taken me up for the weekend after I begged. That was when I still wanted to see her whenever I could, when I was still so sure that if I did everything right and said everything right, she'd change her mind and come back to California and me. I no longer believed in Santa Claus or the Easter Bunny or the Tooth Fairy. I was going into second grade, after all, but at that moment in time, I still believed in my mother. I was in the front seat, even though I knew I wasn't supposed to be, but she didn't have a booster seat or seem to know about them. So I was feeling grown up and maybe only a little bit scared as we drove to get lunch together. She had been reciting Marcia's monologue from Three Sisters. She told me how you always have to be ready to go on. You never know what's going to happen. When a sound like a shot had echoed through the car, I'd screamed, but Jillian hadn't been scared. I remembered that. At the most, she was a little annoyed as she pulled off to the shoulder. She got out to investigate, and I scrambled out after her. "It's a flat," she announced, twisting her hair up in a knot on top of her head and pulling the end through so it stayed. "So we call a tow truck?" My only experience with flat tires at that point had been seeing them happen in the movies or TV shows. She raised an eyebrow at me. "Of course we don't. We change it ourselves. You know how to do that?" "Well, your grandfather ran a garage. He taught me everything." She frowned, her face falling slightly. "You knew that, right?" Before I could answer, she was walking around to the trunk. "I'll show you. Everyone should know how to change a tire." And she'd done it. In what seemed like only a few minutes, she removed the hubcap, loosened the lug nuts, jacked up the car, and put the spare on. And when it was finished and we were back in the car, she looked across at me and held her hand up for a high five. Over the whole drive back to the theater, we didn't have time for a sit-down lunch, so we just got McDonald's drive-thru. I played it out in my mind, how everything would be different now. Oregon was pretty close to California, after all, and I was sure I'd see her more. I didn't know that a month later she'd move to London and I wouldn't see her for 2 years. In that moment, in the car with my mother, a bag of warm fries between us, and a mission completed together, everything had been perfect. "The tire?" Russell echoed. I focused back on him, reminding myself where we were. I wasn't in Oregon with my brother. I was in California with Russell, and we needed to figure this out. "I think so." Russell located the hazards, turned them on, and we both got out. The second we did, I was hit with a wave of heat and the rush of the wind from the cars speeding by on the freeway, dust flying up in their wake. I crossed around the hood of the car to see that I'd been right. The tire was blown out, the car already listening to one side. "I'm sorry," I said, my throat tight. Wiley had made it clear just how precious this car was to him, and I'd still managed to run over a rock or whatever it had been and damaged it. "It's not your fault," Russell said immediately. "I can't believe this. I'd just wrecked Wiley Sanders' beloved car, the one he hadn't wanted us to take in the first place, even though I was surrounded by more horizon than I had ever seen. It was like I could feel walls starting to press in on me." We had a flat tire on the side of the highway in the middle of the desert. Not only did this strongly resemble the premise of one of Dee Dee's horror movies, it also meant the very thin buffer of time we had to get home before my dad was going to disappear. Just like that, it was playing out in my mind. My dad would come back to an empty house. It wouldn't take him long to realize I still hadn't returned from Silverspun, which meant he would realize I'd been lying to him for multiple days now. He was going to be furious, and worse than that, he was going to be disappointed in me, and then I was going to leave. Were we going to have to say goodbye like that in the midst of a fight? The thought made my stomach hurt. "Oh, it's fixable though, right?" Russell asked. He knelt down to look at it. "People get these things fixed." "I'm so screwed," I said, my voice hollow. "My dad, when he gets back ahead of me." "No, it's okay," Russell said, already pulling out his phone. "I'll just call AAA. My dad made me get it after I was in that accident." "Do you even have that service?" I could hear my voice going high and panicky. Reception had been patchy the whole drive, when Russell had been driving. I'd sometimes look down at my phone and see no bars at all. "I do," he said, and I felt myself breathe a little bit easier. "Let me just try to find my card." I nodded, and Russell went back to the Bronco, not even sure why I was doing it. I crossed around to the back of the car. I lifted out the tent and my duffel and raised up the fabric panel. And there it was, a spare tire, and inside it, a jack and lug wrench. "Darcy!" I looked around and saw Russell holding his phone. "I got my card, and it looks like there's a 76 station a few miles from here, and they have a garage. So I'll call AAA, and they can tow us there. We're kind of in the middle of nowhere, so it might take them a while to get to us, but I think it's the best we're going to do." And unfortunately, that's where we're going to have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the novel, The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.